This is Publishers Weekly Radio, the authority on all things books and publishing, with everything you need to know from your favorite books and the world in which they live to bestseller lists and publishing news. Here's the inside story on your favorite story. Publishers Weekly Radio, with your hosts, Rose Fox and Mark Rotella.
Hello and welcome to Publishers Weekly Radio, on the web at publishersweekly.com/pwradio and streaming free on iHeartRadio and iTunes. I'm Rose Fox and I'm a reviews editor at Publishers Weekly.
And I'm Mark Rotella, senior editor at Publishers Weekly. We're bringing you the very best of book talk directly from PW's offices in New York City, the heart of the book publishing world.
On today's show, author and editor Patrick Swenson discusses his debut novel, The Ultra-Thin Man. Then PW Reviews director Louisa Ermolino explains what indie authors can expect when they submit books to PW.
But first, here's a sneak peek at next week's Publishers Weekly bestseller list powered by Nielsen Book Scan.
So on fiction, we have a lot of excitement. There's a new number one, number two, and number three on the list. Lots of movement.
Wow.
These are big summer books hitting the August shelves. People suddenly realizing they only have a week or two before school starts again, and it's time to get into those big, deep, long reads before they have to leave the beach.
Yes, exactly.
So at number one, selling about 21,500 copies, is the new Haruki Murakami. This is very exciting for fans. It's called Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki and His Years of Pilgrimage. And it sold more than a million copies during its first week on sale in Japan. It's now been brought to the American audience. And our review, the PW review, which is starred, says it is a return to the mood and subject matter of Murakami's earlier work. So it's about a train station engineer who tries to reconnect with a group of friends from high school, and he has to sort of re-examine his past and why he was suddenly alienated from that group when he was in college. And we say that the result is a vintage Murakami struggle of coming to terms with buried emotions and missed opportunities, in which intentions and pent-up desires can seem to transcend time and space to bring both solace and desolation.
You know, it's interesting, as you just said, about some of these books pubbing in August. And this is mid-August.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Murakami would have traditionally been published in September, which is the big publishing season. And now a publisher like Murakami's publisher, Knopf, and others have started to release books in August. And this has been going on the past couple of seasons. So when one would think that publishing is dead and we've got those summer Fridays, or at least publishers have summer Fridays. But here's a big book. And as you say, two more top 10 books being pubbed in mid-August.
Yeah, this is on our hardcover fiction list. I mean, these are not minor titles.
Right.
The next one is the new Debbie McComber. She is the queen of romantic fiction.
Right.
Some of her books are romances in the truest sense of the word, the two people overcoming struggles to find their happy ever after. And some of them are more explorations of family, small towns, and interpersonal connections. But she is just an enormous following and is a lovely person. I've had the pleasure of meeting her. And so this is Love Letters. It's a Rose Harbor novel, which is one of her many series. It didn't sell quite as well as Murakami, but still 14,700 copies.
Wow.
Not bad for its first week, and certainly for a $26 hardcover.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing pretty well. And the PW Review says that McComber's mastery of women's fiction is evident in her latest Rose Harbor novel following Blossom Street Brides. And it's there's definitely a romantic thread about it. It's about the proprietor of a bed and breakfast inn in Washington, small town Washington. And she's trying to get to know her guests, get to know the people who work at her inn, and make connections. And there are lots of different threads about different people, what they want, what they need, what they're trying to do for themselves and for other people. And our review says that McComber carefully intertwines her character stories to ensure that none of them overshadows the others, but it is her ability to capture different facets of emotion which will entrance fans and newcomers alike.
Great.
So that's Love Letters. And yeah, that's one of those books where when you pick it up, you know what you're getting. You're getting something that feels good. I can't remember if you were the one I was telling this anecdote to that the other day. I just wanted to read a book about people being nice to each other. I was having a hard day.
No, you didn't, but that sounds...
I was just having a hard day,
right.
And I was feeling really sad, and I thought, I want a nice dinner, and I want a book where people are nice to each other.
And did you actually find one?
Yeah, I grabbed a romance novel off of my shelves, and I went out, and I can't give away which one at the moment, because I'm considering it for a year's best, and so I don't want to give anything away. And incidentally, I can't believe it's only about 2 months until we're going to be publishing the PW Best of the Year list. It's kind of unbelievable. I picked up a romance novel because I knew there would be people being kind to one another. And I needed that little mental health break.
And did it give it to you?
It did. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So that's what a book like this will give you. It gives you, you know, people struggling and then succeeding in a way that can be really tremendously inspiring and soothing.
Yeah. I often do that this time of year. I save my Andrea Camilleri books, as Sicilian writer, for my summer vacation, and for the same reason, it's short. Though they aren't necessarily being nice to each other, they're wonderful mysteries in a wonderful setting with characters you're familiar with, and I really enjoy that certain times, especially when I'm ready to take a break from work, life, New York.
So that's what that vacation is for. Yeah. So it's interesting to see the Murakami and the McComber sort of back to back on this bestseller list. Very different. I think the Murakami is more for people who want a challenge, something to kind of wake up your brain if you've been in this sleepy haze in the summer. And the McComber is the opposite, especially right now with everything that's going on in Missouri that's, you know, sad and scary and very upsetting. It can be just so important to pick up a book where the cover is literally sunshine and flowers and just take a break for a little while. Number three on the hardcover fiction list is The Sixth Extinction by James Rollins. Rollins is a popular thriller novel. This is one of his Sigma Force novels, the 10th in the series, after The Eye of God. And it's about the Sigma Force team, a secret U.S. agency basically travels around the country putting out fires, literally and metaphorically. So this time they have to deal with a research site that blew up and released a virulent pathogen. And they are, you know, challenged at every turn. We say that Rollins makes it all believable. It has everything the genre demands: Nazis, ancient maps, alien life forms, a ticking nuclear clock, and exotic deadly beasts. But somehow he makes it work, and he ties it all together in a satisfying climax. So he's got a 10-city tour. And so possibly some of those people who haven't bought the book this week are just waiting to buy it when they can get him to sign it. But he sold 12,000 copies in his first week out. Not bad at all.
Oh, fantastic.
Not too shabby.
Yeah. Yeah.
And finally, I just wanted to head a little further down the list to number 23, Fool's Assassin by Robin Hobb. I wanted to signal this because we gave it a starred review. Hobb is one of those really interesting, thinky fantasy authors.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, it's been 10 years since she ostensibly concluded the tale of one of her most popular characters, which was Fitz Chivalry Farseer. She decided it was time to bring him back. And her fans are super excited. I know that the reviewer I sent this to was over the moon just to have gotten to receive it, because when you think of a series that you love is done, that can be a little hard, that can be a little sad, and then to have a new book come out is just such a tremendous gift. And so we said the adventure and intrigue are as electrifying and mesmerizing as ever, and the fully realized characters and vivid prose show that Hobb remains a supremely talented author of epic fantasy. So I don't know that it would necessarily make a good starting point, but for her fans who thought there would never be another Fitz Chivalry Farseer story, this is just a fabulous, fabulous, exciting thing.
And this is her fans that have put it on the bestseller list.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, it's sold almost 3,000 copies, which is enough to land it at number 23.
Great.
So not bad for its first weekend.
Sure.
And I'm done talking. I've done so much talking.
It's very good.
I don't usually fill up the time all by myself. So tell us what's going on in nonfiction.
All right. Our highest debut is a cookbook. Comes in at number 3. It's called My Drunk Kitchen, A Guide to Eating, Drinking, and Going with Your Gut by Hannah Hart. Now, we've done quite a few, one might argue too many, pieces on new forms of cookbooks or where editors are looking for cookbooks. And it's for them, by and large, it's been blogs, even though blogs have been kind of dying out as far as places to go for cookbooks. We'll always find, people will find one, an outstanding one. So this was kind of similar, except it was found on YouTube as a kind of joke. And this is where Hannah, 24-year-old woman who had, I think, recently moved to New York, sets out. She was talking to a friend, I believe on Skype or something in the Midwest, depressed, and they decided to start drinking, and she, to cheer him up, she said she was going to cook for him. So she recorded this about her making a grilled cheese sandwich when she came across her first stumbling block. She had no cheese. So from there on, she went on and continued to drink. So this video went viral. But since then, she's actually been able to cook and has come out with a couple of recipes, or at least philosophies for cooking. One is can bake. Inventing things is hard. She says you don't have to start from scratch. Tiny sandwiches. She says size doesn't matter. Just aim to satisfy. So she's got this whole kind of fun young approach to cooking, and this landed her on number 3 on the bestseller list, nonfiction, not just a cookbook, but this is general nonfiction. So
wow.
And we did an interview with her back in July, the end of July, July 20th, and it's a pretty funny interview. So if anyone wants to read it, especially as they're either watching or after they watch the YouTube video, and better yet, buying her cookbook, it's right there for a little more insight into Hannah. So, and just jumping down while we're on the roll on the subject of cookbooks, going down to 31 and 34, Joel Fuhrman has two books, mostly health-related, so completely different from your drunk cookbook. This is a very conscientious book. It's called Eat to Live Cookbook, 200 Delicious Nutrient-Rich Recipes for Fast and Sustained Weight Loss, Reversing Disease, and Lifelong Health. So both published by Harper One. He's no stranger to the bestseller list with Eat to Live, Superimmunity, and The End of Diabetes. We say, in the end, this worthwhile cookbook offers satisfying, nourishing, and user-friendly recipes for a nutrient-rich life. These are all basically plant-based recipes, so he's got 10 chapters on each one. And the other one is The End of Dieting, How to Live for Life. So we have Eat to Live, Live for Life. We have a lot of that in the titles. So that's at number 34, 31 and 34.
So he wrote a book that's basically about a diet, not necessarily in the weight loss sense, but even has weight loss in the title. And then he wrote another one called The End of Dieting. So what's going on here?
Well, his argument is The End of Dieting, it's not to consider this a diet, but to completely change the way one eats. So it's not a diet to lose weight fast or to, and there've been quite a few cookbooks coming out like this. So those are the big ones for the list.
All right.
So we'll see what happens next week.
We will. And of course, we are starting our countdown to those big September titles.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we're going to see some exciting changes a few weeks from now.
Oh, definitely. I'm Mark Rotella.
And I'm Rose Fox, and this is Publishers Weekly Radio.
Next up, Patrick Swenson riffs on identity in the near future. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Rudy Rasmus, the author of Love, Period, and you're listening to Publishers Weekly Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Rotella.
And I'm Rose Fox, and you're listening to Publishers Weekly Radio, direct from the PW offices in New York City.
Today, we've got Patrick Swenson on the line. His debut novel is The Ultra Thin Man. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So, your debut novel, your first book, tell us about it.
My usual response is, well, it's a science fiction, noir, mystery, thriller, space opera, golden age thingy. but that's become a little bit...
very technical.
Unwieldy, yeah. But I had there was a little review I saw not too long ago where a guy called it space opera noir, and I kind of like that. But it's a couple of detectives who are friends who've worked together for years, and now they're contracting for a larger national intelligence organization for this terrorist movement, and things are not what they seem, and they're on the run, and I get to split them up early. And of course, when you're talking about multiple worlds, it makes contact a little bit different. And there's a lot of fun putting that together, and there's conspiracies and aliens and that type of thing.
And your book is set in the not too distant future. When is it set?
It's 22nd century. It's 2113, about 100 years out from now.
What did you do to build the setting of the year 2113 to speculate about how different things might be? Is it more different than, say, 2014 is different from 1914?
No, I my idea was that we're actually kind of picked up a little bit and pushed into that century because alien intelligence that discover them, give them a lot of the technology they need to explore the other worlds and set up colonies. So they're kind of forced into that century a little bit, and there's positives and negatives. So Dave Crowell, my main guy, he loves the old stuff. He's kind of a stickler for the classic days when he, even days that he doesn't remember. But he loves nostalgia, and he loves the old things. So it's kind of a mix. So there's still some things we would recognize, and then there's some electronic devices and, you know, futuristic things that probably if we were just kind of on our own, we wouldn't be there by 2113.
So you alternate narration between two characters. You've already talked a little bit about Dave Crowell. The other is Alan Bindros. Tell us about those characters and why you chose that structure. Give us a little background on the two and their dealings with one another.
Yeah, the Bindros is was an interesting character. How this kind of came about originally with the alternating viewpoints was because it was a little collaborative writing years ago with my brother. Who we were good friends here living in Seattle, and he moved down to California. So we did a little bit back and forth writing with some chapters. So we each had our own little characters. And, you know, it ended up being about 20,000 words over 10 years. So at some point I said, I want to run with these guys. What do you think? Because he wasn't writing anymore. So he said, yeah, go for it. So that's kind of how the alternating got going, and the characters, you know, their own unique voices, hopefully trying to get that across. They were originally both first-person narrators, and then Windows turned into third person. But they run this agency for quite a while together, but they were forced to close it because money was tight, and that's why they took on the contract job.
And so describe to us both Alan and Dave and about the this contract job that they've taken on.
The contract for the Movement of Worlds, this is the terrorist organization. They're set upon to hunt the alien Carol Planko, who's the leader of the whole thing. And so they're kind of contract status, and you know, the regular National Intelligence Organization folks don't really care much for their input here. They're called borrowed hounds, but Crowell is a little bit more weight. He's kind of in charge of the look for the alien movement guy. So that's kind of what their job is, and they're forced into looking into that. But early on, they realize things are not quite what they seem.
So later on, our review says, and I hope this isn't giving too much away, that Brindos is transformed into a clone of Taro Planko, and that throughout the book, there are these concepts of fake people, the thin men of the title, who are sort of copies or clones of actual people. So how did you play around with identity and the sort of concepts of the self in the setting where it's possible to copy people?
Yeah, that was... That was kind of sweaterish, but it's you know, you probably don't find out what that means till a little bit later. But I really like the idea of not understanding for sure who you are. Brindos in particular, has a hard time dealing with that. And he goes from being Alan Brindos to an alien that he doesn't even understand, but he knows who he is, and then he loses his own identity, and he can't remember who he is, and it takes some help from somebody he meets to get him back. There's a drug involved, so there's a little bit with and consciousness and that sort of thing, and how does the how would the body transform, particularly if there's a difference in size and that kind of thing. So, kind of waving a little bit with some science, and but it was fascinating to understand that, and then realizing that if that can happen to him, it can happen to anybody. And so all of a sudden you don't really know who you're really talking to, and a little paranoia sets in, a little Phil K. Dickey and who am I really, sort of thing.
So the title is obviously a reference to Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man, but I'm not sure I've known anyone to mash up Dashiell Hammett and Philip K. Dick before. That's a new one. So how'd you make that work?
There's
that,
a new one. Huh?
That blend.
Yeah, you know, the title is the title came first for anything, actually, and then I was going like, hey, I wonder what this means, and I just wrote to explore it. But there's nothing related to the story of Arnett. I've seen a few people going, hey, there's no Nick or Nora in the story, but although Dorothy is called Dory for short, and she shows up in the book early on, and so yeah, it was just in fact, probably when my brother and I started throwing around a few chapters, I wasn't really into Nora as much at that point. That was a little bit later, so I'm not sure if that was a noir reference to start with, but then I thought, yeah, I want to try and explore that idea a little bit more with a couple of characters and their friends, a little banter, and Crowell has a lost love, and of course right now he's kind of married to his job, and now the job is, you know, trying to kill him, and so there are a lot of noir tropes in there, but it's not strictly noir, you know, it's strictly a retelling of The Thin Man.
And you said that you worked on it for 10 years before you really, in collaboration, before you really got on it as a novel?
Yeah. Yeah, there was like, my brother was writing a chapter, and about a year later, you know, I'd get the next one in. And at some point, 5 years had passed, and that's when I said, you know, I'd love to run with this. Can I do it? So it wasn't really until 2009 that I really picked it up and finished. And that's the year that I quit editing and publishing my small press magazine, Tailbones, and I closed it down that year. And then between September and New Year's, I wrote the last 70,000 words of it. It just all came out in a rush. And so, yeah, it was a kind of an odd gestation of that, you know, starting that way. And then a lot of my brother's stuff was cut or reimagined or twisted. And there's a lot of his words still in the opening chapters, but it was quite a process. But once it came out, it came out. I'm a kind of an organic writer. I don't outline, so which is sometimes kind of hard to do a mystery when you're not outlining. So there's a lot of going back and forth.
So you were just saying you're an editor of anthologies and magazines, and you were the founder of Tailbones. Tell us about Tailbones magazine.
Yeah, Tailbones was a small press magazine for science fiction and fantasy, some dark fantasy and some horror. Started in 1995. It ran 14 years, pretty good run for a small press magazine, and 39 issues, exactly the number of chapters in the book if you don't count the epilogue. And it was quarterly to start with, and the last few years it went three to two issues once my son Ryan came aboard, and then I started Fairwood Press in 2000 to start publishing other writers' collections and novels when I could, and just kind of all on my own. So it was a lot of fun, a lot of work, and I read a lot of slush, and I think over 14 years of reading slush and that kind of thing, I learned a lot about writing as well. And if somebody said that The Ultra Thin Man wasn't ready to be written until I had my hand in Tailbones for a while, But it was pretty well respected for a small press magazine, and a lot of writers got their start there too. Some first sales for writers who have pretty good novel careers going on now.
So you're saying that this was going to be my next question, actually. How did it shape your own writing? I mean, how did the editing or the selecting process shape your own writing?
I think it started to tell me a little bit about what I really liked as fiction, because I could tell writing, and of course this is short fiction instead of novels, but I could tell within a couple of paragraphs sometimes, certainly the first page of a short story, whether this thing was going to work or not, and grab me, and kind of learn to understand what grabbed me as a reader. And so I learned a lot about craft, and a lot of about hooking the reader and characters, that kind of thing. I still have a lot to learn writing characters and as well. So I think it was mostly a process of reading a lot of people's fiction and understanding, oh, this is why this doesn't work. This is why this writer should be doing this. This should be a completely different format, etc.
So I found personally that I've spent so much time being an editor that when I start writing, I immediately become very critical of my own writing. Like the editing kicks into gear right away. Did you have any trouble with that?
I've always had trouble with that. My friend John Pitts, who's also a tour author, he calls it the imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, you know, you're not good enough. This stuff sucks. And, but you know, when I write and I'm writing fast, I'm getting it all out on paper pretty quick. And then I have to go back and then, yeah, I'm seeing it. I have a hard time sometimes reading, just for pleasure critically. Cause if I'm not reading for Fairwood or rereading my own stuff, I'm reading student papers and books that I'm teaching. And it's hard sometimes to get myself away from that.
And what were your early influences in writing and reading?
Oh, I'm a golden age guy. I loved all the space opera from my youth, and then I Asimov and Clark and Heinlein and Silverberg. I read all those guys, and Patricia McKillop was one of the first fantasy trilogies I read, and Ursula K. Le Guin. I loved her Earthsea stuff and Left Hand of Darkness and Phil K. Dick, of course, and then mystery. I've actually read a lot of the old Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys mysteries, and I read Tom Swift and his whatever it was and his little gadgets and then a lot of mystery like Robert E. Parker's Spencer books, James Lee Burke, his Dave Robichaux series, Elmore Leonard. I love Leonard. So kind of a mixture. I was kind of destined to kind of mix the two together, I think, with those loves.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go away.
Book lovers everywhere love Publishers Weekly Radio, now on iHeartRadio.com. PW Radio brings you the best of books and book publishing news. PW editors Rose Fox and Mark Rotella offer lively interviews with your favorite authors and conversations with new authors you'll want to get to know.
I'm Rose Fox.
And I'm Mark Rotella.
Join the community of book lovers at PW Radio.
Every Friday and now on demand at iHeartRadio.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Patrick Swenson, the author of The Ultra Thin Man. He was just talking about his roots in both science fiction and mystery. There are a lot of books right now that are blending speculative elements with mystery elements. Do you see yourself as kind of part of that zeitgeist or that trend, or are you working maybe more in parallel with it? Because you're doing some things that I don't think I've seen anyone else do.
Oh, thank you. You know, when I set it out, because again, 15 years ago, it wasn't even an idea of this, and we weren't really sure where this was going. And when I took off with it, I wasn't really sure where it was going, but I did want to do the science fiction and mystery idea and blend that. I have a science fantasy mystery I've done and working on a little bit too from time to time. So I didn't try to pigeonhole myself into any particular movement or anything, but it just kind of seemed to happen for me. I had an agent who said, it seems like New York is looking for this kind of thing right now. So it's obviously out there. But yeah, I wasn't trying to copy any particular idea, but kind of a mix of ideas.
What is it about science fiction and mystery that works so well together, that's making it such a good jumping off point for a lot of people? Or what made the combination work for you?
Well, I think for me, with science fiction, it's always the sense of wonder and awe, and not really understanding what was going to happen next. And the smaller scale mysteries like that too. So, you're following along, going like, wow, what's happening with this character, and what's the mystery, and how is this going to get solved? And there's no way this is going to happen. So I think it's kind of all part of both of them have this sense of discovery and this idea that nothing is quite right until you figure out the big mystery at the end, or with the science fiction, setting and milieu can be very important as well.
Now, you've been a high school teacher for a good part of your life, it seems, and teaching.
Starting my 30th year here this year.
No kidding.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you've been teaching literature and creative writing.
Yeah, and in fact, although I started, I was kind of a blend of, see, there's the blend again. I actually went through as a music teacher. I was a high school band teacher for the first 9 years and doing some English classes. And then I just, with the writing and all that kind of thing, I switched gears, and been full-time English for longer now. But I teach a senior advanced placement literature class, kind of focused on British literature, and I have a creative writing class. I got to pilot a science fiction film class that's very popular at my school. I'm also a newspaper advisor and teach the journalism classes there as well.
That sounds like so much fun. And, for being
a lot of work.
Well, yes, I'm sure. I'm impressed that you have time to do any writing yourself. How do you fit it into your day?
Yeah, well, sleep is overrated, I think, but that's my main thing. Because I'm also still doing, 4 to 6 titles of my own, with my own press, Fairwood. And I have a 12-year-old, a late arrival kid with some special needs, in Orion. And I don't know, it's during the school year, I'm getting maybe 5 hours asleep, a night at the best, and trying to catch up along the weekends.
Wow.
And in fact, now that I think about it, with the way the novel turned out, my friends are always going, so which number clone are you? Are you 42? Are you 66? Because they couldn't figure out how in the heck this was all getting done with the amount of time I had in the day. So, and that's partially why, this book is a little later than I would like to have come. I talk about it being a lifelong dream, but it didn't really have to take this long.
Well, I'm curious about...
Yeah, so I don't really know. I just try and hit things an hour here, an hour there, and suddenly I have a book, or suddenly I have a class syllabus, and wow. So next week I get to start going back to the school and start prepping for classes in a couple of weeks.
Well, I'm curious about your time as a music teacher and high school band director. I mean, what was the inspiration for music? I mean, and do you see any similarities in your writing, or was this something completely different?
Yeah, no, I don't know. In fact, there isn't any music in my book, although I have a ghost murder mystery set out in the Olympic Peninsula that I'm working on. It's very much about music and the main character working on composing a symphony and that kind of thing. But yeah, I was in high school. I was a band nerd. I was band all the time. I loved playing. I was a trombone player and a piano player. And my director was fabulous. He was wonderful. Sometimes a little scary when he yelled at you and that kind of thing. But and doing some praise and doing this. I want to teach. Main thing I wanted to teach. And I thought that's what I was best at, even though I was doing some writing in high school. And I think it could have gone either way. It was just the combination of band and all the extracurricular stuff after school and English, and all the extra papers I had to grade, you know, the combination was killing me. I had to pick one or the other. So I don't think it was necessarily a connection with the writing, other than I loved both, and I just one of them had to kind of go.
Hmm. So you mentioned that this was a lifelong dream to make this book happen. Are you planning to write another one? Do you think it'll take you another 10 years, or hopefully not?
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, I'm, you know, about 88,000 words into book two.
Oh, great. Is it a sequel?
It is a sequel, yeah. I'm contracted with Thor for one, so I'm hoping this does well enough that they're willing to look at it. But, yeah, it's definitely a sequel, and it's got a similar type of title in the series that riffs off another noir title. I want a different noir title and a different noir author. So I've not publicly announced this very loudly yet, but the working title right now is The Ultra Big Sleep.
That's
great.
which is those who will read The Ultra Thin Man will understand the importance of sleep a little bit in the book. So it goes on from there. And then there's a third one, although it's a very small idea because I don't outline and I kind of see explore as I go along what's going to happen. But so I'm working on it, and my summertime is my prime writing time to get a lot of this done. So, and my agent's asking, how's book two coming? So I'm working.
The title of the next book is The Ultra Big Sleep, and you were just talking about how very little of it you get. So I don't know if that works into the the plot at all.
I figured it worked great for, although it took too long, but it took great for getting the book that I had, just starting with the title. Mm-hmm. I thought this way great, but sleep is a very, very important part of the novel, and you see that happening in The Ultra Thin Man. Where they are losing time. They realize, you know, at one point Brendos has lost 18 hours of his life. He doesn't understand what happened, and things are going on during those sleepy times.
Hmm. So, you know, from the side of things, it's hard to know what it's like for an author. So I'm just curious, if you don't mind talking about it, what was it like getting a starred PW review on your first book?
I was quite shocked, actually. I was just hoping that I'd get a Publishers Weekly review and maybe it would be okay and decent, you know. So I'm absolutely thrilled. I had no idea. And, posted it right away. Like, ooh, even with a few spoilers, just saying, no, look, here it is. So I really hadn't thought about it too much until I realized that the book was out there in ARC form, advanced reading copy form, and people are going to be looking at it early. So it's really a thrill. I'm really, really happy.
Well, I'm so glad. And before we wind up here, you've been a teacher, an editor, now an author. From those different vantage points, do you have any advice for people out there who share that lifelong dream of being a published novelist?
My advice is button chair, because hours are fleeting. In fact, when I wrote the 3/4 of this book in those 4 months in 2009, I was writing every day for an hour, and I found my hour at school during my planning period. I thought, you know what, I'm going to plan every time except that hour, so I have that same hour to write. And it worked miracles. I literally 4 months, and then even beyond that, when I was rewriting, how fast the words came out when I actually put in the time. And you don't have to sit and write for 3 or 4 or 5 hours a day. So keep putting words on paper and persevere, because perseverance is huge in this thing. And try and, get some contacts and learn people in the business as well. Because that, you know, sometimes that is a little bit about who you know that can help, bootstrap you a little bit.
And how did you do that? Did you attend writing workshops or retreats? And again, this is basically for any hopeful writers out there.
Yeah, I run a writer's retreat now, but I went to Clarion West in 1986, and way back when, and which is a 6-week basically writer's boot camp. Where you just live, breathe, and eat, and sleep, writing, and pretty much nothing else. And my fifth week instructor was David Hartwell, editor at Tor and editor of my book, The Ultra Thin Man. So I actually got to know him over the years, and I saw him at conventions, and he saw an early novel that he had passed on. And when my agent was working on the deal memo for this novel, he came back to me and said, "So your editor says you've been waiting for this novel for 15 years. So, well, you know, which is about as long as Tailbones went. So I have an excuse, I guess, a little bit. I'm glad that I was able to get it to him, but I probably could have got it to him a little sooner. But attending conventions and writers' workshops are great. You meet these people. And a lot of times they'll say, "Hey, what are you working on?" And send it when you're ready. And writing can be pretty insular, and you need to get out there sometimes and meet some folks in the business and understand what's happening.
Well, yeah, that sense of community is so important.
Oh, it sure is.
We've been talking with Patrick Swenson. You can find his book, The Ultra Thin Man, in stores right now. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. It was great fun. Appreciate it.
I'm Rose Fox.
And I'm Mark Rotella, and this is Publishers Weekly Radio.
Next up, PW Reviews director Louisa Ermolino provides some useful tips for indie authors. Stay tuned.
Book lovers everywhere love Publishers Weekly Radio, now on iHeartRadio.com. PW Radio brings you the best of books and book publishing news. PW editors Rose Fox and Mark Rotella offer lively interviews with your favorite authors and conversations with new authors you'll want to get to know. Join the community of book lovers at Publishers Weekly Radio every Friday and on demand at iHeartRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Rotella.
And I'm Rose Fox. You're listening to Publishers Weekly Radio, direct from the PW offices in New York City.
Every week, we get insider info from Publishers Weekly editors and contributors. And today, our very own PW Reviews director, Louisa Ermolino, is here to tell us about what indie authors can expect when they submit books to PW for consideration. Hello, Louisa.
Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Rose. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you here. So since Book Life is really getting underway as a way for indie authors to submit books for review the way that publishers have been able to, I thought it might be useful to get some information out there about what authors can expect, because I think a lot of these folks aren't as familiar with how we work as the publishers are who have been working with us for years.
Correct. We always think, we assume because we're in the business that people understand things. But actually, when you're not in the business, you don't understand. So it helps to clarify it. In fact, we have to explain it to publishers. So why not people that are just writing their first book or their fifth book and wanting to join the fray? We've always had standards for traditional publishing. We've required two copies of a galley, which is a pre-publication book. We've required that it comes early. We've required information about that book from the publisher. And now that we've expanded to indie writers, things are a little bit different because people are publishing them differently. But we still like to have two copies. We also accept ebooks. And the wonderful thing is that we are considering these books in the same way that we consider traditionally published books, which is a huge step in the industry. I don't think anyone else is doing this.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, and we're handling them exactly the same way. They run in our reviews sections in the magazine right alongside reviews of traditionally published books.
Correct.
And in all those cases, we give our best honest critical opinion. So PW reviews can be positive, can be negative, can be mixed, but we're going to give those books the same respectful, detailed assessment that we'd give books from anyone.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting to see how much is out there that is quite good, mm-hmm. that maybe would not have been able to be published. And I think more and more writers are going this route. I mean, there's hybrid publishing. There's the field is wide open, and we're leading the pack.
And I mean, it is really hard to get a book published. I mean, to find a publisher to publish the book. And what I've been finding, be it your first book, your second, or your third, as I've been looking at the nonfiction submissions, independent submissions, I've been seeing quite a few people whose submission I've seen is, in fact, their second book that they've written. The first one might have already been published. I've seen people who are editors at various magazines. And so I've been seeing people who do have a lot of experience with writing, and for some reason either have not been able to find a traditional publisher, or, as you had said, who wanted to just do it on their own, to just try and wing it, to eliminate that. So have you been seeing that in fiction as well?
Yes. Also, it's an arduous process. You have to get an agent. The agent has to sell the book. And to sell the book to a publishing house, unless you have someone very powerful in that house, you need to have several people across the board green light the project, and there's a lot of considerations they have because they're investing money and time and a whole staff. So they're very particular, and it not necessarily has to do with quality. It has to do with a lot of other factors. So I think even authors that have been traditionally published decide that they want to take more control over the situation, and they've been publishing independently. We've got some wonderful soapboxes on this, if anyone wants to look them up on Publishers Weekly.
And they can, right on the website.
Yep, just click on the opinion tab, and you'll see the soapbox submissions, all of those individual columns that people have written for us.
Right.
And on the front for the self-published authors, when they're submitting books to us, is there just anything they should know to expect from the process? I mean, I think we're still kind of putting our process together, but do you have a sense of how long it takes from when they first submit to when a review might run if we choose to review the book?
Well, the books are vetted, and then they come to us, and then, of course, they go through the regular channels and get vetted again. But we also have this great program, Galley Tracker, mm-hmm. so that when you send a book in, you can sort of follow it along the process, which is something that we didn't have before. So you can know what's going on. I would say be patient. I would say maybe 6 weeks is the longest it would take. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly worth it because we have really special reviewers and very special editors.
And we should say that traditional publishers also wait as long, if not longer. So it's not that they're being set aside or put aside.
No, there's no line of demarcation.
Yeah,
absolutely. And to what you were saying about quality, I've published a couple of starred reviews of indie titles. It's great to see them come through and to see how much my reviewers love them. You know, I get these really sincere notes of praise from the reviewers saying this is a great book, not a great indie book, but just a great book.
And since you two are in the trenches being editors, do you see certain genres get more submissions?
Well, you know, I'm handling the genre fiction, the romance, science fiction, fantasy, horror, and those genres have always been places where writers can get very adventurous and will comfortably strike out on their own. Romance was at the forefront of digital self-publishing when people wanted to write raunchier stuff than could get carried at Walmart. And in science fiction, the trend has been more towards micropresses. So, for example, our guest on the show today, Patrick Swenson, is running his own tiny little press that publishes 4 to 6 titles a year, in addition to being an author. So in both cases, it was very easy for people in those genres to take the step towards self-publishing, either digitally or in print. And so I get a lot of submissions. I don't know if you've noticed, Louisa, but my weekly sections of the magazine have been getting longer and longer and longer because
yes.
I'm seeing so many great self-published books and less great self-published books, but titles that are certainly worthy of consideration.
And with you, Mark, I always remember memoir is one of your categories, and that's a huge...
Right. Huge.
Indie publisher. Are you seeing that?
Oh, yeah. It's huge in traditional publishing, and it's big in independent publishing. And I'm seeing a lot of personal memoirs, survival memoirs, or personal survival memoirs. And then I see them crossing over into various genres like sports, like music. And then after that, I get a little bit of music history, sports histories. Memoirs. by and large the largest category that I show up that show up in my mailbox or wherever. After that, I have to say, are cookbooks. I think a lot of people are just because of the difficulty getting cookbooks published, but also the difficulty in finding someone to do a good quality job on cookbooks. I've been finding a lot of people submitting cookbooks for review. And some health books, but cookbooks also quite a bit. So those are the biggest ones. I think memoirs, sports, and cookbooks.
Well, cookbooks would be great because you can do a niche. Mm-hmm. A publisher might be less inclined to do, you know.
You're right, absolutely right. A smaller, like a specific ingredient cookbook, mm-hmm. like a tomato cookbook.
Or a specific location. When I went to visit my father in rural Arizona last year, I came home with a cookbook from his small town that someone had basically photocopied and spiral bound and was selling in the souvenir stores. And that's not something that a New York publisher would be interested in, but for the people of that town to collect the recipes from everybody in town to open the book and see all the names of the people you know, that matters.
Well, I've been seeing a lot of restaurants publish their own books and do a beautiful job on it. I think the West Coast, San Francisco, the whole Bay Area, there are several in Sonoma Valley there. I've seen three cookbooks coming out of there, restaurants from there, and well-known restaurants. I've seen that at resorts. And again, they do a beautiful job, and they come out with a really nicely printed cookbook.
So, and the wonderful thing is they have a platform.
And they have a platform, exactly. And they print as much as they, you know, as many copies as they need, and they sell them right there in the store or in various bookstores in the area. So, yeah, so we've been seeing a lot of that as well.
This is certainly an exciting time.
It is. So, as I mentioned, there's a lot of crossover between self-publishing and small press publishing. And you'd mentioned that there were a few small press titles that you just wanted to talk about since you were here on the show.
Well, I wanted to emphasize that Publishers Weekly has always been a great champion of small presses, tiny presses, translations that get neglected in the marketplace sometimes. And we are great heroes for them. And there's one that I'm looking at. It's Grove Press, which is not tiny, but it is an independent press. It's Will Self's book, Shark, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. And it's set in the States. And it's very interesting. It's a great book. He's pretty well known. And then we have a book, Reign Over Madrid, which is a translation by Andres Barba, which is something that I'm sure you would never see if someone like Publishers Weekly didn't promote it. It's Hispa Books Publishing, translation of a great Spanish book.
And these are all books that we've seen or that we've covered. I know the Will Self we did.
We've covered them.
So
we can
even
look forward to them.
Great.
And people can find the reviews on our website as well.
Absolutely. Great.
So what else do you have? I'm curious, just curious to see what you have.
And we have some historical romance. Mm-hmm. Her Royal Highness Princess Michael of Kent. That's from Beaufort Books.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
An epic sweeping novel, which recounts the true story of England's invasion of France in the 15th century. And historical romance is huge.
And who would know better than a member of the British royal family?
That's right. This is, I have another one I'm looking at, it, which is from Iowa. The Lovers Set Down Their Spoons.
And this is from University of Iowa?
University of Iowa right. Press, correct. It won the 2014 Iowa Short Fiction Award, a debut collection by Heather Slomsky. So again, someone to look forward to. We have another translation, Nadja Marie Eidet, by Two Lines Press. Mm. These are presses that you would never hear of, except that we promote them. This writer won the 2008 Nordic Council Literature Prize.
Oh, great.
Guess where that's set. We have
Chile.
Love in Ordinary Creatures by Gwyn Hyman Rubio, who actually is a New York Times bestseller. But a small press, Ashland Creek Press, out of Oregon.
Wow.
We have a very exotic, The Drum Tower from Black Heron Press, Farnoosh Mashirishi. And last but not least, we have Real Santa by William Hazelgrove.
I remember this being talked about. And who's publishing that one?
This one is published by Kohler Books. K-O-E-H-L-E-R-B-O-O-K-S. Actually, we've done many of their titles.
Yeah.
So it's wide open. It's a great field. And it's an exciting time. It used to be a writer left family and friends and moved to a garret in Paris and invested 2 years. And now, you know, you can just do it on a Sunday afternoon.
You know, I don't know that that ever actually happened so much. At least in my field, I remember the first time I went to a Romance Writers of America convention. I attended the Rita Awards, which are the big awards for the genre. And one author after another got up and said, I just want to thank my husband who's home with the kids tonight. Because, you know, these are all these women whose kids had gotten to the age where they were being a little more independent. And they thought, well, great, now I can finally sit down and write that romance novel. And so there was no garret in Paris. There were 5 minutes here and there in between peanut butter sandwiches.
And then there's the women who thank their husband for leaving them so that they had to make a living and decided they could write a book.
Right.
Yeah, writers will find a way.
Right.
Find a way, one way or another. Well, Louisa, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us that roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. And now a final word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Patrick Swenson, author of The Ultra Thin Man, and you're listening to Publishers Weekly Radio.
And that's it for today's show. I'm Mark Rotella.
And I'm Rose Fox, and you've been listening to Publishers Weekly Radio.
Join us next week for an interview with Kara Braden, the author of The Longest Night. And we'll also have lots more juicy insider info on best-selling books and the nuts and bolts of publishing.
In the meantime, you can find this and every episode of Publishers Weekly Radio on our website at publishersweekly.com/pwradio and also on iHeartRadio and iTunes, available for you to listen absolutely free. So check the site every week for a brand new episode giving you the inside story on your favorite story. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Publishers Weekly Radio Show.